Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. The time's 5 after 9 a.m., March 30th, 2012. With me today is Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and myself, Stedman. And this morning, we are going to bring back 6 bills on the agenda. And we're going to start with Senate Bill 91, Sport Fishing Guide Services. Then move on to Senate Bill 119, Athletic Trainer Licensing, Senate Bill 182, Pupil Transportation Funding, House Bill 65, Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund Grants, House Bill 104, Alaska Performance Scholarship, and then we'll conclude this morning's session with an update on Senate Bill 192, the Oil and Tax Gas Production, which will be kind of a few more analytical runs on the progressivity slide or slides and the mechanism that we had talked about yesterday. House Bill 284 and House Bill 285, the FY13 operating and mental health budgets have been postponed until 1 p.m. and we'll have an afternoon session. So I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 91 by Senator McGuire regarding sport fish guiding services. This is the second hearing on this bill. We've heard it for the first time March 20th. At that hearing, we adopted a committee substitute version M. My intent today is to bring the bill back for further review and look to the will of the committee. Do we have anybody here representing the bill sponsor? If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
For the record, my name is Cheyenne Ely, intern for Senator McGuire.
And I think this is your first time at the SCARE Senate Finance Committee?
Yes.
Okay, we're not that bad. If you could just give the public a brief description of the bill as a reminder.
SB 91 guarantees the continuation of the sports fish guide licensing and reporting program, as well as provides an effective date. SB 91 extends the sunset date of the program, which is already in place. Legislation for this program was first passed in 2004. This program has proven to be beneficial to the sport fishing industry as well as the resource managers. It requires licensing and regulation of sport fishing operators and sport fishing guides and sport fishing vessels. The program has provided an average of 1,541 sport fishing businesses licenses and 1,828 sport fishing guide licenses annually. 90% of license holders are Alaskan residents. The sport fishing guide industry has taken more than 2.6 million clients fishing from 2005 to 2010, totaling more than 625,000 guiding fishing trips in Alaska. Guided sport fishing has become an integral part of Alaska's tourism economy. In 2007, $1.39 billion was spent on licensing and stamps, trip-related expenditures, fishing packages, equipment, and real estate used for fishing. This spending supported more than 15,879 jobs in Alaska and provided $504.3 million in income. This bill provides accurate accounting for Alaska's resources, which are being harvested. Federal law for guided halibut sport fishing is tied to the Alaska sport fishing logbooks, and failure to keep this program in place would likely result in the development of federal logbook for halibut, which would create duplication of efforts at a later date. Alaska is exempt from participation in the NOAA Fisheries Salt National Saltwater Angler Registry Program, in part as a result of the information collected through the sport fishing guide licenses and reporting program. This committee has passed this bill before, and I would urge members to continue their support. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have one fiscal note from the Department of Fish and Game reflecting a $400,000 cost to administer the program, which has been requested by the governor in the FY13 budget. We previously had public testimony. Do we have any questions, concerns from the committee? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for Senate Bill 91 Finance out with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note to the next committee of referral.
And we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, you can inform your boss that you were successful this morning in moving the bill along. Thank you for coming in. Next up, Senate Bill 119 by Senator Meyer regarding athletic training licenses. This is the second hearing on this bill. We heard it for the first time the 1st of February. The intent today is to bring the bill back for further review and look to the will of the committee, and we have representation from Senator Meyer's office, if she can introduce herself and who she represents, and then give the public a brief overview of this bill, please.
For the record, my name is Christine Marisigan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer. Senate Bill 119 provides for a licensure for athletic trainers to be licensed in the state of Alaska. We are one of three states that do not license athletic trainers.
I see you've been, your backup has arrived, but we're going to take a look at the two physical notes. We've got 10 physical note from the Department of Administration, 1 physical note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for $26,500,000 in receipt-supported services in the FY13 and $1.8 in the out years. We've previously had public testimony. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for Senate Bill 119, Labor and Commerce, from committee with individual recommendations, attach fiscal notes to the next committee of referral.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next up, Senate Bill 182 by the Senate Education Committee regarding pupil transportation funding. This is the second hearing on this bill. The first time we heard it was the 29th of March. The intent today is to bring the bill back for further review and look to the will of the committee. Senator Meyer, could you explain to the public briefly what we have in front of us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 182 again. I'd like to thank the committee members for considering the bill. As I explained yesterday, the pupil transportation represents a large portion of our education funding. And unfortunately, the current way of funding pupil transportation is inadequate, and the monies are taken out of the classroom to go to fund the pupil transportation. We think this method of going on a cost basis instead of a per pupil basis will help assure that the money for pupil transportation goes to pupil transportation, the money for the classroom goes to the classroom. Also will help in provide consistency between school districts as far as what is provided with pupil transportation. Also, in the long run, it will save the state money because we can now have a larger sample to go out for bid versus on a statewide basis versus doing it by each individual district.
Okay. We've had one fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development for the following estimates. An FY12 supplemental in the amount of $8,103,300, FY13 appropriation for $10,450,300, which is in addition to the $62,202,700 currently in the governor's FY13 operating budget, and one additional full-time position. We have any questions, concerns from committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Meyer, I was just kind of wondering how many school districts does this bill apply to, or how many would benefit from it?
Through the chair, I'm going to ask my staff to help me on this, but this will benefit all the school districts that currently offer student transportation. In fact, I think there's even a school district South Naknek that actually flies their students, that's their school bus.
One of the questions I had.
That would benefit from that as well. But as far as the number of school districts, do we have that?
Yes, for the record, Edra Marledge, staff to Senator Meyer. Senator Olson, this represents 49 school districts out of the 53 in the state. There are 4 that do not have transportation programs.
So it's primarily, Mr. Chairman, primarily for those students that, or yeah, those school districts that don't have bus service, or they're just in town, they're not eligible for these funding.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, they currently do not provide transportation at all. If they were to provide a transportation program in the future, then
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Senator Hoffman, may we have a motion including the letter of intent, please?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for Senate Bill 182, Education, from committee with individual recommendations attached, fiscal note, and the letter of intent with to the next committee of referral.
And we have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations attached, fiscal notes, and the Senate Education Committee's letter of intent. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill to the next committee of referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, House Bill 65 by Representative Edgman regarding Senior Citizens Housing Development Grant Funds. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it on the 5th of March. And the intent today is to bring the bill back for further review, look to the will of the committee. We have representation from Representative Edgman's office. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and give the public a brief explanation of what this bill is, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Clark, staff to Representative Edgman. And on behalf of Representative Edgman, I pass along his apologies. He was momentarily delayed this morning. HB 65 would benefit senior citizens across the state by including regional housing authorities among those entities eligible for grants through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund. The Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund contributes funding to organizations that develop quality housing for older Alaskans who make up the fastest growing segment of our population. While the fund's grants have been available to municipalities and 501c3 and 4 nonprofits since the fund's inception, Alaska's regional housing authorities have not been eligible. HB 65, which has the support of AHFC, will correct that omission. In most cases, grants through the Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund complement funding from a variety of other sources, often Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund grant is the final piece of the puzzle that allows a project to go forward. Funds can be put toward pre-development expenses and new construction, as well as acquisition of properties, accessibility modifications, and rehabilitations. Alaska's 14 regional housing authorities span from Ketchikan to Barrow and are among the state's most experienced developers of affordable housing. Making housing authorities eligible for grants will not increase spending through the Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund. It may, however, widen the selection of projects competing for grants and increase AHFC's ability to more effectively allocate funding.
Do we have any initial questions? We've got 10 fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. For the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. We previously had public testimony. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass House Bill 65 from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note to the next committee of referral.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. We'll have a brief at ease while we set up for the next presenter. We're at ease.
We'll go back on the record. Next up, House Bill 104 by the Governor regarding Alaska Performance Scholarship. This is the third hearing on this bill. We previously heard the bill on January 18th and February 15th. The intent today is to bring the bill back for the purpose of adopting a committee substitute and look to the will of the committee. Now, Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt version S?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt version S of Senate Bill CS for CS for House Bill 104 Finance as a working document.
And I'll object for explanation and ask Mr. Peterson to come forward from my staff. Technically, the Finance Committee staff.
He works for all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator Stedman and the Senate Finance Committee. The version R in front of you, the one that you just adopted, has changed from the previous version. There have been a few different committee substitutes that have been passed around, but the latest version that the committee adopted was version R. Version R was the last version that the committee adopted. This version that you just adopted is version S. So I'll explain the changes between version R and version S. Starting on page 2, line 9 and 10, we inserted the words, "an institutional accrediting body recognized by the United States Secretary of Education." The previous version had accredited by the United States Secretary of Education, and the department made us aware of the fact that the secretary does not accredit schools. Page 2, lines 23, 24, we added the words, "Alaska residents who have attained an Alaska high school diploma by examination after January 1st, 2011. The department also made us aware that that's the correct term for the GED, the Alaska high school diploma by examination. Page 3, line 7, added the exception for provisions of subsection C, that's the new GED component. Page 3, line 9, an exception for subsection D, which is the waiver of the core academic requirements. Page 4, line 3 through line 30, almost the entirety of that page, is the new grace period language. Previously, we had just stated that if a student couldn't access the courses in their school, they would receive a waiver. Now we've taken the grace period language that was in regulations, right from the regulations, and modified it a little bit, and inserted it here on page 4. The grace period that's in regulation expires with the graduating class of 2012, so this will continue that grace period so the commissioner can waive the requirements, and I'll explain what that grace period does. It says that the commissioner shall waive the core academic requirements for a high school graduate if the student submits an application providing proof the student was unable to complete the academic requirements because of illness or disability, or because those courses were not available in the student's school district. The commissioner has 30 days to approve or deny an application for waiver. High school graduates who receive the waiver will then have 12 months to finish the core academic requirements in a school district that sponsors that student. And for the GED graduates, they will have 24 months to complete those core academic requirements. Next change, Mr. Chairman, is on page 5. Lines 5, 11, and 17, we deleted the word diploma because that was an incorrect terminology, as we were made aware by the department. Conforming changes. Next change is on page 7, line 19. At the request of the department, we changed that date from October 1 to September 1 of each fiscal year. This section is also the two-thirds, one-third breakout, two-thirds for scholarships, one-third for grants. We inserted some new language on page 7, lines 21 through 25, that says, if an insufficient number of qualified applicants are awarded grants before the end of the fiscal year, the commissioner shall redeposit the remaining funds into the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. So how this will work is, of the earnings from the principal of the $400 million fund, two-thirds of that will go into scholarships, one-third will go for grants. If there aren't enough students that can use all of the scholarship funding that's available, the remaining balance of that funding will go into the grants, If there aren't enough students to use all the grant funding that's available, whatever's left over at the end of the year will be redeposited back into the overall higher education investment fund to be used in the subsequent fiscal year. Page 7, lines 26, this isn't new. I just wanted to remind the committee that this is our small school carve-out provision that stays in the bill. Page 8, lines 6 and 7, we changed that language to say that the commission shall redeposit the remaining amount back into the fund from which it originated. Previously, what we had with the small school carve-out provision was that the funds that were not used went back into the fund that it came from. Those accounts would have already been exhausted, so what we, instead of depositing the money back into the higher education fund so it couldn't be used, we'll send the money back into the account from which it originated so that those funds could be used for other students. The only other changes, Mr. Chairman, page 16, lines 24 through 26, that's some transition language that identifies where the $400 million that was appropriated to the AHFC last year, the section of state law where that's found, that's the funds that will be used to capitalize the new Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. And then on page 17, at the request of the department, we made some changes to the effective dates to make the program easier to manage so that they have time to draft regs. Finally, Mr. Chairman, one other thing I wanted to show the committee, there have been some questions. If you'll turn to page 9, lines 2 through 5, that's the payout mechanism that is in the legislation. Some members had asked why we chose that method. We worked this out with the Division of Legislative Finance, and I'll pull it up here. So this is the spreadsheet that shows how the payout would occur. If you look at the top in FY13 and read across row 5, you'll start with an investment account beginning of year balance of $400 million. The earnings, 6.5% is the earnings estimate that we've inserted here. It would be $26 million in the first year. 10% of that, the payout would be $40 million, 10% of the investment account. So two-thirds of that would go to the scholarship account, $26.6 million. The demand for scholarships would be $8 million in FY13. So $18.6 million would then be deposited into the grant account. Payout to the grants in FY13 are estimated to be $13.3 million. So available for grants would be $32 million, only $3 million in need. So you will end up with a transfer back into the higher education investment account of $29 million. So at the end of that year, the investment account, the balance would be $415 million. So then that goes back FY14, you start with $415 million, and you do the same calculation for that year. So you'll see that if you look at column B, the principal that will be in the higher education investment account will stay solvent until around FY30. That's when you start consuming the principal of that fund. So between FY13 and FY30, the earnings of the fund itself will be enough to pay for the scholarships and the grants. FY30, you start running a deficit and start consuming some of the principal. Legislature at that point will have to decide what to do with the program. But if you change this amount up here in column D to a lower amount, say 5%, there wouldn't be enough to pay both the scholarships and the grants for that period of time. So you can see that you're in the red by FY15. So the 10% account is a way to make sure there's plenty of funds available for both the scholarships and the grants for many years to come, and the remaining balance would just be redeposited back into the overall higher investment education fund. So that's why we chose that payout method, Mr. Chairman, and concludes my comments.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, originally the program was contemplated for scholarships to be included at 400. Was there any consideration to add additional funds to accommodate the grant portion so that the fund would be more stable?
Mr. Chairman, yes. David Teal, who did the spreadsheet, added a block right here for additional deposits. We can punch in whatever number you want, and you can see how that would affect the payout. So, $400 million originally. If you had say $40 million. Oops. Maybe I'll ask Mr. Teal to.
I think rather than do that, because we can, you know, work those numbers a lot, but we'd be 20 years before we'd start worrying about the principal, and by then we'd have a, you know, a track record on the performance, and the performance may be substantially different than what we anticipate here, up or down.
Well, when I'm here 20 years from now, I don't want to work on that problem.
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Hoffman's question, I just added $40 million as an additional deposit. It only expands that for another fiscal year. It doesn't do much.
Any questions on the Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one. Is the references on page 5 to the general education development examination, is that the only alternative to actually the high school diploma, or is there any other tests that are acceptable to receive your high school diploma?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I defer that question to the Department of Education. Or I believe the commissioner is here, but my understanding is that there is not. That the it's called the Alaska High School Diploma by Examination is the only alternative if a student doesn't graduate from high school.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any questions? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, maybe we can have Ms. Diane Behrens come forward. Would you like to introduce yourself for the record, please, and who you represent, and then maybe explain the bill or talk to the bill a little bit if you'd like? Do you have any comments?
Certainly. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill. As you know, we do have concerns about certain amendments to the bill. The governor remains very committed to the program that he has been an advocate for the last 2 years. So we are very interested in seeing a fund established, but we would like to do so without a dilution of the message behind the Alaska Performance Scholarship.
Okay. We have any questions for Ms. Burns? We've got 4 fiscal notes in your packet. 10 fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, Tax Division, a 0 fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development, 10 fiscal note from the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education for the Alaska Advantage Education Grants in the amount of $3 million, which is currently in the governor's FY13 operating budget. One fiscal note from the Senate Finance Committee for $4,900,000 for the Alaska Performance Scholarship. This amount, in addition to the $3,100,000 currently in the Senate version of the operating budget, will fully fund the program in FY13. We've previously had public testimony. Do we have any final questions, concerns? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass Senate Bill CS for CS for House Bill 104 Finance from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note to the next committee of referral.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill to the next committee of referral. We're now going to take a brief at ease while we set up for the next presenter from PFC Energy. We're at ease. I'd like to go ahead and come back on the record. Rest of this morning, we're going to bring up Senate Bill 192, Oil and Gas Production Tax. We'll kind of have a kind of a rerun from yesterday with PFC Energy on the issue that we're working with progressivity, moving it up to a gross versus a net calculation. We've asked them to come forward and do a few more slides, slicing it in several different views. And you might have some other little bit of information as Mr. Mayor thought about it last night and worked through these slides. So with that, I'd like Mr. Mayor to go ahead and introduce himself again for the record, who he represents, and kind of walk us through these slides. And I'd just like to, before we start the committee, to note that we are now on our third binder and growing, and hopefully we'll have a bill before we're at the end of this binder. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I, on that note, I shudder to think of how much color toner use I am responsible for here. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice of PFC Energy, a global energy consultancy, and project manager on the assignment that we are undertaking here for the Alaska State Legislature on analytical support for fiscal terms, oil and gas fiscal terms reform issues. I will step through the slides relatively briskly today, unless people would like to go slow, mostly because many of them it's essentially an expansion of the deck that was presented yesterday with a range of additional ways of analyzing things added in as per the requests of the chairman and of the committee, including higher price levels and a range of other things. There is one additional sort of fiscal option included in that, so when it comes to looking at that, I will slow down and we can look at that in a little more detail. To start, though, where we started yesterday, as we noted, two fundamental problems in the existing fiscal structure, that being the question of decoupling, the fact that when we have large-scale gas production, that can bring down production tax value when progressivity is part of the profit-based production tax, that the solution in CSSB 192 is one that requires significant administrative burden on behalf of companies and a great deal of capacity on behalf of the state of Alaska to actually be able to audit in terms of splitting out costs between oil and gas, and that this is a problem in the way that decoupling is handled in the current bill. And similarly, that under the existing structure, options for incentivizing new production are relatively limited, particularly because one can't do anything with progressivity or with the base rate to particularly incentivize new projects, because any time you change any of those things, one then needs to be able to separately account for different streams of production, essentially ring-fence those and have different tax returns and allocate costs differently between them, which is fundamentally not practical to do, and that the only way around that in terms of incentivizing new production in the existing structure is to have some sort of gross revenue allowance to reduce production tax value for particular streams of production. As we noted, the alternative proposed at this stage is instead taking progressivity out of that profit-based net production tax, and instead levying that net tax at the flat base rate of 25%, but then to retain an element of progressivity, putting in a progressive or severance or gross tax into the system that would be non-deductible for profit-based production tax purposes, levied on gross production net of royalties, be levied solely on oil, and use a progressivity structure not dissimilar to the current one, where there's a couple of thresholds which it kicks in and progressivity coefficients that apply at different thresholds. Yesterday I presented one option for what that could look like. Today I want to present that again, but also another option for how that might work. The first that we looked at yesterday is for a... was essentially modelled at looking at economics on a stylized, fairly stylized basis for existing production and saying if we roughly smoothed out the curve so that it held a constant level of government take from somewhere around current prices upward, what would that look like? And the numbers that produced something that looked like that were a $65 level at which the severance tax would kick in with the progressivity coefficient of 0.25, going all the way up to $125 gross value of production, gross value at the point of production, meaning a 15% rate, and then progressivity being reduced at that point to 0.05% and then capped at a maximum of 20. As I was doing the analysis on this, looking not over the life cycle, but solely at 2013 numbers and what that looked like, one of the things that occurred to me was, particularly since budgetarily $100 oil and the revenue that we see for the state of Alaska seems to work at that level, and one of the things we've talked about is freezing essentially the government take at that point, which is about 70% government take between, so 70% to the state and the federal government, 30% to the companies. If one were to freeze that at that $100 point, what would that look like in terms of inputs for the structure? And we can essentially achieve something that comes very close to that by having the severance tax start at $60 with that same 0.25 rate, but then having the reduced progressivity rate then come in at not at $125 but at $100, and have that reduced progressivity coefficient even just a little further down to 0.03% with, again, the 20% cap. And I'll go through a series of numbers in the slides to come to show what that would look like compared to what was presented yesterday. Once again, to briefly summarize in terms of what the benefits of going to this gross structure for the progressivity while retaining the net profit-based structure for the base tax is, of course, that by doing so, we no longer have to address the issue of decoupling. The base 25% tax can be levied in exactly the same way as it is under ACES, that is, simply looking at all production, all costs, because there's no question anymore of differential rates, so the question of the value of gas versus the value of oil is no longer an issue. It's all simply just 25%. So that goes away, and one can address the decoupling issue without all the administrative difficulty, both for companies and for the government, required by the decoupling measure in CS for Senate Bill 192. And similarly, significant incentives can be provided for new production by providing for a lower rate or indeed possibly, for instance, no severance tax whatsoever for particular streams of new production, whether that be production from new areas, production from new plans of development that are particularly authorized, or production above some specified decline rate that's fixed at this point in time and extended out into the future. So there's a wide range, therefore, of ways in which one can incentivize new production, and also it's a structure that by looking at different thresholds for progressivity, different rates, there's a wide range of levels of government take that can be achieved using this framework, depending on the parameters that are applied. And we'll look, once again, at two of those in the coming slides. There was a question yesterday, I believe, from Senator Hoffman about what the forward curve based on futures contract prices looks like at the moment for crude oil. The best way of doing that is to use the WTI marker, since that's the most liquid and has the longest forward curve. WTI, of course, at the moment trades at a lot of discount, obviously to Brent and also to Alaska, North Slope, West Coast crude. I think in terms of spot prices, off the top of my head, I can't remember, that there may be a $10 or more differential there. But the important point here is the shape of the curve and the fact that we get down, for instance, when we look out all the way out to 2020 delivery dates for the futures contract, down to price levels that are even below $90. So this is yesterday's contract prices for delivery from everything from May 2012 through to November 2020. To come back to the 2030 revenue comparison we were looking at yesterday, I've extended this from the $150 level all the way out to the $200 level and added in the second severance tax option here. So severance tax option one, of course, is the one where progressivity continues up to $125. Severance tax option two is the one where it stops at 100, though it kicks in at a slightly lower level and essentially freezes take at the 70-30 split for FY 2013 at that $100 level and upward. So we can see that, in fact, because progressivity under the second option kicks in slightly lower at the $100 level, for instance, revenues are slightly higher than they are under the first option that we looked at yesterday. They're broadly similar to those under ACES below that level, though they may be, again, very slightly higher for a couple of these price decks. It's hard to match perfectly. But in particular, from the 100 level upward, that 70-30 split is frozen in place, and 70% of the take goes to the state and the federal government and 30% to the contractor. So there is, as a result, declining revenue to the state from the production tax compared to the other options as a result.
So do you want to, Janik, again, go over the severance tax option one and severance tax option two, because I don't think we've touched on option two too much other than a brief explanation again. So can you tie that into your chart here, please, on page seven?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, if I may, perhaps it might be useful to briefly switch to the next slide to have a look at the chart, and one can see how these look, and then we can go back and explain what those thresholds and coefficients are. So in these first two charts, we have revenue from production tax to the state on the left and cash to companies on the right. The red line is what things look like at the moment under ACES. The yellow line is the very slight difference that comes from CSSB 192. As you can see, the main divergence here is that sort of slight difference around the $120 level that comes from the different progressivity coefficient that's applied under CSSB 192, the 0.35 rather than the 0.4. And then as we get up to the 190-200 level, there starts again to be some small split. I think if we extended this out to 230, for instance, and beyond, we'd start to see a split as the cap on CSSB 192 applies. But below the 200 level, there's very little difference. Because that 60% cap under CSSB 192 doesn't bind at these price levels. The blue line is option one, the option that we looked at yesterday. It's the scenario where progressivity on the progressive severance tax would kick in at a rate of $65 and be progressive at a rate of 0.25% up to a level of $125. And then from that point on, continue at a rate of 0.05% until a cap of 20% was reached. And that gives us that sort of straightening of the line that we see around $120 and at a rate that probably is a little above a 70% government take split. If we look at option number two, in which progressivity would start ever so slightly earlier, $60 rather than $65, have the same initial coefficient, which is the 0.25%, but then the inflection point occurring not at $125 but at $100 with an even further reduced progressivity coefficient after that of 0.03% is what gives us the green line there, which essentially from $100 onward is a straight line at a slope of a 70-30 split, 70% government take, 30% take to the companies. So that's what that option looks like when graphed out in terms of revenue from production tax and in terms of cash to companies.
And just for clarity, this does not include the $400 million and 20% capital credits as reflected on slide 7?
That is absolutely correct, Mr. Chair. All of the 2013 numbers in this sense are prepared and consistent with Department of Revenue methodology, where their production tax forecasts also do not reflect those credits. They account for those separately in the state budget. There are two reasons for that, I guess. One is the question of being accounted for separately in the state budget. The other is the question of the fact that those credits are entirely exogenous to the economic model that produces these things, because they don't come from the production and the costs that went into producing these numbers, they are something that one really can only predict by knowing how many new developments are occurring at the moment, how many people are drilling wells and claiming exploration credits for them, and what the time frame over which those are likely to be claimed. And that's the sort of detailed knowledge that I think probably only the Department of Revenue can give you an accurate picture of, because without having access to the detail of that confidential information, it would be very difficult to forecast what that credit would be, since it's not credit that comes from existing production, it's credit that comes from entirely separate activities.
But when you're running the FY13 numbers, they're using $400 million which is the 20% main capital credit, just for the public, that's deducted off the top before the tax is submitted to the state. So there's some presentations here that we've struggled with, where it's not reflected in the numbers and not put on the table. And the committee needs to be clear if we're looking at $450 million in credits, or $430 million in credits, or we're looking at $850 million in credits. It's a significant impact on the Treasury. So I'm just, if we're running FY13 numbers and we know that's the credit target that revenue's using, and revenue uses that $400 million and to get to their bottom number, why wouldn't we have that in this chart? I mean, I'm still struggling with that concept, because we're isolating FY13. We know the targeted capital expenditures, the targeted credits claimed against the Treasury, and taken off the top. So can you help me with that?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I did look at this question yesterday and then have a brief discussion with some of the folks at the Department of Revenue. My understanding is that all of their projections in terms of the bottom line figures that they present for revenue from production tax and the other components of the system don't include that $400 million figure, which comes from credits not from existing production but claimed either bought from other producers or claimed against the state for instance capital that is attributable to projects that are not yet producing, or for exploration, or any of those other things that credits can be claimed for that are not claimed against existing production tax liability. So the Department of Revenue figures and these figures match in this sense in terms of methodology, which is that credits that are endogenous to the system, if you will, credits that come from capital that is spent by producers who are currently producing, whether that be development capital or exploration capital, credits that are claimed against production tax, and if memory serves me correctly, the figure from Department of Revenue for that for 2013 is $475 million. We get a similar result when running the numbers through our model. That is included in these figures, and that is netted out from the production tax numbers that you see here. What's not included, either in these figures or in the Department of Revenue figures, is that additional $400 million in credits that they forecast, which they account for separately and don't show in their own forecasts, and for the sake of comparability with those numbers, we have not included here either. But it's important to bear in mind that is an additional cost to the Treasury.
Right, and I think one of the things we do here is we restate some of that stuff and show the credits actually in there, show the gross revenues before the deduction of the $400 million credits, and then flow the credits out in their proper format, versus doing the calculations, taking out the net impact of the credit, and then starting with an adjusted gross income. And one of the things we need to be clear about here is that we use an all-in format. In other words, barrels times price, and flow out the credits in the proper format, even though the industry may submit a net check. So we need to be a little, so I'll get with you on that, but I think we're going to be more interested at this table of looking at the whole gross value and the total impact of all the credits, because we've struggled here with that subject, where we've again had presentations that would imply that $400 million of credits don't even exist, and we've struggled with that and requested directly that Department of Revenue put them on the table. We want to see the entire flow of the cash, not adjusted numbers. So we'll work with you on that and make sure that we understand if we actually have a formatted presentation in a particular way that's different from that, that we all of us here at the table understand what we're looking at, so we don't have a $400 million surprise. Hey, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your attention to detail there, because we talk a lot about percentages, and if you just factor those numbers in that you're talking about for at say $120 a barrel, and I was looking at it yesterday while we were talking, that's about $170 million every 1% tax one way or the other. So when you talk about $400 or $800 million, that's a big swing and a big swap in cash. So I appreciate the concept of making sure keep the credits in mind, because not a lot of attention is paid to them. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue, Jack, on this. So can you so I guess this concept, the severance tax two, if we go back to page seven, the severance tax option two, because we haven't seen that before here, this concept is to hold the cash flow fairly constant at $100 and below $100, but allow more cash to move over to the industry side of the table north of $100.
Mr. Chair, and in particular, at $100, under $100 to $110, depending, but under all these regimes, what we see is basically a 70% to 30% split in take between companies versus government, both state and federal. And what this third option does is it takes that 70-30 split and essentially freezes it from that point onward. So from that point onward, for every additional dollar that's earned, every additional dollar in the oil price, 30% of that benefit would go to the company and 70% of that benefit would go to the combined federal and state governments.
So instead of freezing at 130 or 125, you're freezing at 100?
That's correct.
Okay. And theoretically, we could freeze at 150. I mean, that's a policy discussion here. We can freeze that at any point, or unfreeze it like it currently is. Okay. Senator Hoffman, did you have any questions on the magnitude of cash? Okay, go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, so as we said, slide 8 looks then at, for each of these options, what graphs out that question of revenue from production tax and what cash to companies looks like in each of these scenarios. And then the following slide, slide 9, deals with what that looks like for total state take and for total government take in absolute dollars, in millions of dollars. If there are no questions on that, Mr. Chairman. The following slides then show, again, using that financial year 2013, for each of these price levels, both in terms of percentages of government take and in terms of dollars to the Treasury, for each of the components of the system, what that looks like for in more detail for each of these regimes.
Okay, so let's just stop here for a minute to make sure everybody's, including myself, is, because we haven't had these, just for the public's knowledge, these slides are being made up late into the evening and early morning. So we haven't had an opportunity to sit down and go through these. In fact, they were just printed out and put in our binder right before we sat down. So, this slide on page 10, which is FY13, and that is the revenue forecast FY13 with or without the additional $400 million in credits applied.
Without the additional $400 million in credits, Mr. Chairman.
And we probably want to try to footnote some of that stuff on these slides, because it's a huge amount. 400 credits, okay. And this is the homogenized version.
That's correct, Mr.
Chairman. All in?
Yes.
So I'll work on that concept, how you get all in without the $400 million in credits applied, but I'll work on that so I clearly understand that. Because my interpretation of the homogenized would include all credits applied against the Treasury, net cash stacked on the table.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond with 2 points. One is that to produce these numbers for a model, one can only, other than simply plugging in numbers that come from a Department of Revenue forecast, the only way to actually generate these internally to the model is to look at the credits that come from existing production, because there one has an estimate of what the costs associated with that production is, what the production volume is, and from those various things, what the credits associated with that capital expenditure in particular is. And so from there, one can internally to all of that develop an estimate of what the capital credit is and look at that, as you say, at this homogenized level. The question of what the amount of the other capital credits, that is, credits occurring to not current producers, is fundamentally external to the model in that sense and can only come from additional analysis that someone has done looking at the detail of that data as to what those credits might be and when they might be claimed. The second point I'd make, Mr. Chairman, is part of the reason this has been presented in the form that it is at the moment is simply for consistency with both with Department of Revenue figures and with the way the state budget is structured, which is that revenue from production tax, as it's recorded, does not include those credits. Those credits are accounted for separately. In terms of understanding the net, you're right. It's absolutely important to understand that there is a liability, essentially, of $400 million that goes with that revenue stream that may be claimed against the Treasury. But it's not, in terms of numbers that you would subsequently see, for instance, in 2013 in the state budget for what production tax income was, my understanding is you would not see there the impact of those $400 million in credits either.
Go ahead and continue with your slides.
So to step through the slides very briefly, we have levels of revenue and of government take for races in financial year 2013, with around, again, that 70% level at the $100 level, but rising to 79%, 80-odd percent by the time we reach the highest price levels here. By contrast, committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 doesn't look enormously different on this front, particularly if we look at the overall government take figures. And a big part of the reason for that is we still have levels of government take at the $230 level that are very similar, because, of course, while there is a 60% cap under CSSB 192, that cap doesn't bind at these price levels when one is looking solely at FY 2013. If we were looking across a range of years across the project lifespan because of the impact of inflation, we would start to see a difference there. But looking at FY 2013, we don't. The only difference that we see is because of the impact of the 0.35 rather than the 0.4 progressivity coefficient, which makes only a relatively minor difference between these two regimes in terms of what they look like and in terms of the revenue that they generate. If we look then at the first severance tax option, that's the 0.25% progressivity from $65 going all the way up to $125. What we see is, again, and it's probably easier to do the revenue comparison on the earlier slide where these were put side by side, but revenue at the $100 level, that is slightly less than for CSSB 192 at the $100 level, but then diverges from that point. And what we see is the lower government take figures of freezing essentially at around the 72-73% mark from slightly higher than current prices upward. Again, that freezing point looks lower if we look across the life cycle, again, because of the impact of inflation. But this is what things look like when we look at a 2013 level. step forward then to see what this looks like for the second severance tax option, which is to say 0.25% progressivity from 60% to 100, and then 0.03 from that level onward. And again, what you see is that flattening out with the 70% take at $100, $110, then held pretty much absolutely constant from that point onward. To come back to that question of...
If we could stop there and jump back to slide 7, please.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Still just trying to catch up to the new option or an option on the table that moves the take numbers around. But if you look at the state and the section, the second one to the right, the state take numbers at 110, the under option 1 to option 2 would be about $100 million increase going to option 2, but then that spread would reverse.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and that's a function of progressivity kicking in at the $60 level rather than the $65 level. So that takes – what that means is, for instance, under option 2, total state take at the $110 level is almost identical, for instance, to what it is under CSSB 192. And, in fact, it may be very slightly higher for some of the lower price levels.
So then at, I guess, north of 110, it would just – increase the sharing relationship or the cash moving across the table from the state to the industry.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, and holding it at that 70-30 split.
Okay. I guess we can jump back then to that page 14, new production.
To come back to this question we pondered yesterday on incentives for new production, as I noted then, through this architecture, significant incentives for new production can be provided by either reducing or perhaps eliminating entirely the progressive severance tax on some or any combination of production from new areas, production from new plans of development, and that could be determined through the regulatory process as to what plans of development qualified as genuinely new production, or production above a decline rate that one fixed at this point in time and extended out into the future. Here we've looked at two things, taking that basic rate of the severance tax in both of those two options, and then looking at what the impact of a reduced rate on that would be if instead of that 0.25% progressivity rate starting at $65 or at $60, depending on the two options, one instead simply levied progressivity at a rate of 0.505% from that point onward with a cap at a maximum of 5%. And the following slides again show that sort of generic higher cost 10,000 barrel a day new development that we've been looking at to look at the sort of impact of the economics on some of these things. Before showing those slides, one of the things I wanted to note, which is important, is the impact of inflation when looking at this sort of life cycle analysis. Of course, under ACES, thresholds and coefficients for progressivity are specified in nominal terms without any indexation. And as a result, when we look at economics over the long term, rather than simply the 2013 numbers, we see the effects of what sort of ultimately referred to as either bracket creep or stealth tax, which is, that's to say, the impact of inflation shifting what those thresholds mean in real terms. So in real terms, as prices increase, the thresholds for progressivity decrease over time. And so the higher take that comes with progressivity steadily occurs at lower and lower price levels in real terms because of the impact of inflation. So, for instance, the severance tax options that are currently modelled and shown in these slides, similarly at the moment, are shown assuming that those nominal thresholds. And as a result in some of those charts, what you'll see is that the severance tax can be seen below that sort of 60 or, in the second case, $65 level at which the severance tax applies, And that, again, is that result of that bracket creep over the lifetime of the project, meaning that there is actually severance tax at lower levels in real terms in later years. And so in that sense, particularly, for instance, if one were to look at that question of freezing government take at a particular point based on FY13 data, along with such an approach, it does seem to me that it's seriously worth considering the application of price indexation to the thresholds for progressivity to get rid of that question, so that if one is designing a system to look in 2013 like it's a system that makes sense, that in 10 or 20 years' time, as inflation changes the meaning of those thresholds, that they continue to make sense into the future. So to start briefly with that benchmark, stylized new development. If we look at what that new development looks like under ACES, this is something that essentially has negative NPV at every price level, including at the $100 level, with a rate of return of about 10% under ACES at that $100 level. It faces government take over the project life cycle of around 78% at the $100 level and rising to about 85% by the high $200 levels. If we look at what that new project then looks like under CSSB 192, the reduced progressivity coefficient does have a small impact on that. Our rate of return for this project hasn't shifted, but we've gone from a very slightly negative number at $100 to a very slightly positive number at $100. And again, with the impact of inflation at those higher levels, we've brought down government take just a little, sort of north of $180 or so. But by and large, this looks still very similar to what it looked like under ACES. If we look at what it then looks like under that severance tax option with 0.25 progressivity, starting at $65 and extending all the way to $125, what we see is, as we say, a leveling out over the life cycle, including factoring in that question of inflation and the impact of inflation, at around the $100, $110 level, and seeing a sort of 75, 76% split going forward, moving up the price deck. And we've increase net present value a teeny bit, certainly more, for instance, than the transition from ACES to CSSB 192 saw, so we at least have net present value of about $30 million for this project, it's a hypothetical project, at the $100 level and an 11% rate of return, but still, you know, not enough to get such a project beyond a basic hurdle internally for a company, let alone to be competitive with other sources of funds. If we were then to say, what does that look like if we apply the 20% maximum for the first... So if we apply the severance tax for the first 7 years only at a 5% level, then reverting to the higher severance tax with a 20% maximum and progressivity going up to 125, we can see that then reduced level of government take, NPV rising to $77 million, IRR rising to 12%, and reduce levels of government take overall, particularly at the higher price levels. If we look at what such a project would look like under the second severance tax option being proposed here, that's option two, where progressivity kicks in at $60 and extends up to $100, with then a lower coefficient after that as well. What we see actually is economics that look not that dissimilar in terms of overall levels of government take compared to the reduced rate under option one in terms of where the reduced rate under option one applied for the first 7 years. So the levels of government take we see between slide 19 and slide 20 are very similar, but the economics on slide 19, that is with the reduced rate for the first 7 years, look significantly better. We see a $77 million NPV in that first case of the reduced rate for 7 years versus of 35% with simply the option to severance tax applied but no reduction in the rate. The reason why the economics look better on slide 19 than on slide 20, despite the fact that the levels of government take are very similar, is of course the fact that significantly more cash is returned to the company in the first 7 years. The overall level of cash returned to the company from the project as a whole is about the same on those two slides, but the amount being returned in the first 7 years is higher on slide 19 than it is on slide 20, and that's the reason why the economics look better in that case. If one were to similarly apply that reduced rate for the first 7 years when applying the option 2 severance tax, the severance tax where the main progressivity goes up to 100 and then tends to flatten out after that, we get, again, improved economics from those greater cash flows returned to the company in the first 7 years, and are now getting up to sort of 84 million NPV, an IRR of 12%, still not breathtaking, but at least getting closer toward ability for such a sort of stylized project to meet hurdle rates. And finally, on the final slide here, if we look simply, my apologies, I seem to be one off with the actual slides being shown on the screen. My apologies to those in the gallery behind us. On slide 22, what it looks like then is if simply that 5% maximum rate is applied with no 7-year window, but simply applying that maximum 5% for new production without a time limit on it, and we get then an NPV of 119 million, for instance, and an IRR of 13%, and levels of government take that are now in the mid-60s, for example. If there are no questions, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on to the
next slide. Yeah, no, keep going.
Here I've simply redone the analysis from the previous deck on possible 20-year revenue impact of a reduced rate for new production. I ran the numbers again and realized I think we had some. This was an analysis done very late at night with trying to pull together a lot of data in a short period of time. I think we overstated the impact in the previous set of slides shown yesterday. So these are updated numbers, and then we've looked at both option 1 and option 2. But what you can see is that it's a relatively minor impact in terms of applying that new rate, that reduced rate for new production, even when looked at over a 20-year time period. And that's because while it's a significantly reduced rate, it's only on that progressivity coefficient, on that progressivity portion. And at least if the data one uses, for instance, the DOR forecasts, including all the potential new production that they see, looking forward, to at least get a sense of looking above a 6% decline, applying that rule, what might be considered new production. The impact in terms of revenue to the Treasury on that 20-year time horizon, based in present value terms, is moderate, but not certainly not massive.
Okay. And just as a reminder, when you're running the 20-year revenue impact, this includes credits. It doesn't include credits.
Once again, Mr. Chairman, it includes those credits that come from the production that is occurring. It doesn't include, for instance, exploration credits or, again, those credits that come from any new developments being made by people without existing production.
Right, so this would be kind of, we should look at this then as the impact on the legacy fields, the three major producers?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Okay. The primary purpose of the analysis here is not necessarily so much the absolute numbers as it is the delta between applying the high rate only and applying the reduced rate to understand what the impact of that reduced rate is.
Okay.
And finally, I wanted to, in line with Senator McGuire's request, provide the benchmarking analysis for a range of at $20 increments from $60. We've done it all the way up to $200, and one can step through and see what that looks like. What we see, of course, for instance, looking at an existing producer, is at $60 a barrel. Actually, you know, ACES really doesn't look so bad. It's, for instance, below what we think we see for government take at the high cost level in North Dakota on something like the Bakken Shale, though above most of the OECD rates. But again, what one will see at these lower price levels is that things like North Dakota and Texas, particularly for the Eagle Ford and the Bakken, which are the higher cost developments there, as opposed to simple sort of conventional onshore developments in those states, what we see is that at higher costs, those levels of government take higher, lower prices, those higher costs developments in fixed royalty regimes have higher levels of government take. That's simply a function of something we've discussed at this table a number of times, which is that fixed royalty regimes are inherently regressive with regard to price, so the government take goes up as price drops, and that's particularly the case when costs are high, because there is proportionally less and less divisible income at low prices to be split, and there is a fixed amount of royalty going to the state or to the private landholder in some of these cases. So that's the reason why at $60 a barrel, some of those fixed royalty regimes no longer look as good as they do at prices closer to where we are today. And at $60 a barrel, of course, ACES, CSSB 192, and the severance tax option we're talking here are all basically identical, because this is before progressivity kicks in on any of these.
So we're more attractive than North Dakota at $60.
At $60. certainly not at current prices, Mr. Chairman.
But we don't want to.
Mr. Chairman, I note that's also for unconventional production. If we look at what North Dakota looks like for conventional onshore production, I mentioned it looks, and I think we have this here, it would look significantly better, and that's, again, the result of the lower costs associated with that, again, meaning that there's more divisible income at those price levels. As we step through $80, we start to rise to where ACES for an existing producer is again, below everyone other than Norway. By $100 a barrel, almost any of the options that we're talking about here for an existing producer are below any OECD country other than Norway, but the two severance tax options that we're looking at are below ACES and 192. At 120, we see that gap start to widen. By 140, ACES and CSSB 192 are basically the same as Norway, while the two severance tax options are significantly more competitive, but we see the difference between the two of them based on the difference in progressivity at those levels. At 160, again, we're now ACES and CSSB 192 significantly above Norway and getting very much in the top of the pack, even looking at the non-OECD regimes. By 180, even more so, and this is where we start to see the split between ACES and CSSB 192 once we've factored in the impact of inflation. And by $200 a barrel, ACES is sort of up there with Algeria and some of those very, very high-taxing regimes. CSSB a little lower, but still above Norway, for instance, at those prices. And then the two severance tax options, as we see, staying at that lower level above most of the OECD countries, but, for instance, well below Norway.
Okay, and then there's a series of slides right behind us. It looks like you just added a 7% time horizon on it. Is that the difference on the kind of the two sets of slides here?
The second set of slides, Mr. Chairman, is then looking at what this looks like using our economics for a new development rather than for an existing producer. And so it's running the new development profile for ACES through the model, and also then looking at what it looks like when the incentive for new development is applied for 7 years, and then what it looks like when, for instance, simply a 5% maximum is applied with no 7% time horizon. And again, stepping through those, so we see those all again roughly in the same place at around $60 a barrel. As we get to 70, we start to diverge, and again, ACEs for a new development at $70 by $80 a barrel, rather, is once again up by Norway and keeps heading north as we step through the deck, while the two severance tax options stay fairly close together here. I should note, in fact, I think the way these economics have been run, this is the first of these severance tax options for the new development has the reduced rate applied for 7 years. The second is the second severance tax option, where progressivity caps out at $100, but I suspect it doesn't have a particular incentive for new development applied to it. The third one there is severance tax, looking at simply the reduced rate with the 5% severance tax maximum rate applied and no time limit on it whatsoever. So those are the options that are being benchmarked there. And again, as we step through the deck, we see, for instance, at $120 a barrel, ACEs get up to countries like Turkmenistan. And as we go further north, at $180 and $200 a barrel, for a new development, with the high level of government take that comes from some of the costs that go with the new development, ACES is right up there at the top at these very high price levels, while the severance tax options we're looking at are, again, stay clustered more around the middle of the deck, well below Norway, though above at these price levels the rest of the OECD, with some particularly the significantly lower level when we take that 5% maximum and apply it without a 7-year window, but simply as a blanket allowance for new development.
On a lighter point of view of this, we are more stable in Syria.
That is indeed true, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'd hope anyway. And then you have on page 40 to 43, your last slides, I see you've got some calculations, net present value, and pricing, and could you give us a brief explanation on the last four slides, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I really want to provide this as an appendix more than anything. My own view is that this sort of generic view of ACES for an existing producer was useful to us when we were doing the initial analysis and looking at levels of government take and what this looks like. Now that we've got into a more micro level of detail, I think actually the FY 2013 numbers that we've been looking at are probably more useful to us at this point. But since we've done it in the past and since it was mentioned at the committee yesterday, I wanted to provide these slides as an appendix to simply show what these options look like when we run that generic sort of low-cost profile for a $200,000 barrel a day producer with a 6% decline through the model and what those look like. The first two slides will look very familiar from previous presentations of ACES with a government take figure of about 75% at the $100 level, getting up to 83% at the $230 level. Those slides will concur with what we show, for instance, on that benchmarking chart that we've just looked through for an existing producer, what that looks like for CSSB 192, where things are really largely similar until we get to the point where, after the impact of inflation, we see the freeze of the government take it about at the 60% level, which I think is probably about the $170, $180 mark or so, where we, instead of getting up to 83%, we're at sort of 79%, essentially. My apologies, I've once again allowed myself to get ahead of myself on paper and not with the slides. Here we see that the 79% maximum for CSSB 192. To move on to then what the severance tax looks like, again, instead freezing it more around current prices, for instance, $120 onward, we get that 72% government take, relatively steady across the price deck when considering, of course, the impact of inflation. And then what it looks like in the third option presented here, where instead that freezing occurs lower at about the $100 level, and what we get is a 69-70% relatively flat take from that point on.
Okay. Do we have any questions on these slides before we go on to the next subject on Monday, which will be credits? And then we'll have to try to tie that credit discussion back into this without, you know, just so mechanically we all understand how they flow together. I think Mr. Mayor is interested in moving on to a credit discussion. So if there's any other questions that the committee members have on this or the mechanics of how they interrelate, just let us know and we'll try to sort that out or set up some discussions in your office or whatever to go over some of this stuff. Because I know there's a lot of information, there's a lot of moving parts, and we just need to make sure we understand, you know, how this comes together when we try to make a soup so we don't end up like, something that was, we don't want a toxic pot of finances in the middle of the table when we're done. Okay, with that, we're going to then adjourn the morning meeting. We're going to pick up this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to go to Senate Bill 121, PERS and TERS Retirement Plans. And then Senate Bill 100, PERS and TERS Termination Costs. And then House Bill 284, FY13 Operating Budget. And House Bill 285, FY13 Mental Health Budget. Unless we have other questions, we are adjourned.